everyone, and welcome to Dark Natter, the podcast where what is below stays below. I am John Richter, and I am delighted to be joined today by Nick Whittaker, who is, as I've probably said before, one of the good things about doing this podcast and moving in kind of writerly circles is you meet some dead cool writers, and Nick is a dead cool writer. But I will shut up now and let him introduce himself.
Thank you very much, John. Nice introduction. So I'm Nick Whittaker. I'm a predominantly science fiction writer, although I am starting to venture into fantasy. Just love John's work with Dark Natter as well. So when he asked me to be on, this is just an honour, absolutely, to talk about horror and dark fiction and all the rest. It's great.
Brilliant. No, we're very lucky to have you. This is going to be good. And one of the other good things about doing this show and stuff is, obviously, sometimes we'll get guests on and they'll want to talk about a thing that you already know or have seen or have read. And other times they want to talk about a thing you haven't seen and you've never heard of. So I didn't know what Nightbreed was. And I've done a spoiler there, haven't I, and told everyone what we were talking about. But that's it.
It'll be a
title. Good point, yeah. It'll be a big label on the episode, if that's true, actually. You're right. For this whole series, I've been trying to keep an aura of mystery about what the show's going to be when it's there in the heading. Never mind. I didn't know it was a Clive Barker thing. And actually, to my shame, and of course you're showcasing Clive Barker stuff in the background. In fact, I think I can make out that is Cabal. Is that Cabal?
That is Cabal. I mean,
that's brilliant.
That's cool. The soundtrack for Nightbreed as well, just up there.
Oh, fantastic stuff.
That's
ace. And I didn't really know, I'm not that big of a Clive Barker person, even though I'm, I masquerade as some sort of horror guru when I'm clearly not. To my embarrassment, until last night, I'd never even seen Hellraiser, except for watching half of it when I was a kid and being so traumatised and I couldn't bring myself to watch the other half. Finally watched that last night and thought, right, I've got to do that because it's going to come up.
This is just a real serendipity, because you watched Nightbreed for the first time the same night that me and my partner watched it, to rewatch it like a couple of weeks ago, was it last week? But yeah, we watched Hellraiser last night as well. So
that's
we were
that is a weird coincidence. That's really funny.
And we choose the same days.
And I guess I should try and resist the urge to talk too much about Hellraiser, because that's not what we're here to talk about. But it is the Clive Barker. If you wanted to say to somebody, if somebody said, "Who's Clive Barker?" you'd be like, yeah, "Watch this," because I think that was his directorial debut. 1987, it's just like an absolutely mad onslaught of really depraved, sadomasochistic gore drinks. But it's not, that makes it sound like it's got no plot and it's like rubbish, but it's not rubbish. It's dead good and really clever and funny.
Yeah, I mean, watching it, because I think it was the first time I'd watched it for a good several years, and it was, I think I'd forgotten how much of almost like a one room plot, not one room because it's a house.
Yeah, no, agreed.
80% of it is just there. And that's what I think it's a sort of a very, everyone like that's because of sort of his resources for making it and that kind of thing, was that he just needed it to be quite a small cost as well. Just have it there. I mean, the special effects must have blown the budget on that, I think, quite a lot.
Yeah.
So I wonder if that was sort of the idea behind it, although it is based on a book, which to my shame, I haven't read the book of it. But it's very good. And just that whole madness happening in that house.
It's like a funny pitch as well. And it's like, a woman, a couple move into a house, and in an upstairs disused room, there's the blood of a dead guy that is sort of resurrected gradually bit by bit. And that scene where it sort of congeals back together into a skeleton, it's like, oh, that's ace.
I think that's probably one of the best scenes in the film, for sure.
Yeah, I agree with that. And some of the kind of, but I guess the reason for mentioning Hellraiser, not just because we both coincidentally watched it last night, is because it does sort of define what Clive Barker's all about, which is like pretty sick stuff. His movies have got brilliant special effects. So, to be clear, he's a writer originally, obviously an author of horror works, but then he went on to direct some himself. Mm-hmm. And I guess as a writer, it's always cool when someone does that, because you think, I could have a crack at that one day. Not that.
We can hope.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you could dream about that. And I sort of read that he was basically people had started to, you know, he was famous and a big name. Mm. Stephen King called him, like, I think Stephen King said, I've seen the future of horror, and it's Clive Barker.
That was his big boost, was sort of like to get that quote for sort of just rose him in everyone's eyes as like, oh, let's watch out for this guy and see what he does kind of thing.
Yeah, sure. which is fair enough. And and he sort of, so I think he'd had some adaptations of his work into films, but they'd been a bit crap, or he didn't rate them. So he thought, right, sod it, I'm going to do one myself then. Which is Hellraiser. And it's, I would say it's a really good cracking, you know, you can imagine people's reaction to watching that in the cinema. Like, what the hell did I just see? But we are not here to talk about Hellraiser, of course. What we're here to talk about instead is another one of Clive Barker's wrote the book himself, which is the book you showed, which is Cabal. The movie version of that book is called Nightbreed. Written and directed by Clive Barker, came out in 1990. And I forgot the opening bit where we explain what this show is all about, so I should probably squeeze that in. we as the Dark Matter podcast, we are the custodians of the Hall of Pain. And every show, we have a guest. Sometimes it's my mate Liam, who is the normal co-host. Sometimes it's other people. And Liam is to date still too shy to do a three-man or a three-person
move.
But we did one once, but we'll get him on eventually onto a three-man sort of thing. So between me and Liam's here in spirit, and between us we assess whether the pitch is worthy of a place in the hallowed halls of the Hall of Pain. That's the assessment we're going to make of Nightbreed today. Nick, you are pitching Nightbreed. Why are you pitching Nightbreed? What do you like about that movie?
Well, I think this could be quite a, would you call it a dark fiction or not? Because it's got quite a big sort of thing to the whole story, is that the monsters and the creatures in the film aren't necessarily the bad guys or the evil thing in it. They're just sort of this community that live under a graveyard, kind of minding their own business for most of it. And it's actually the human characters that are the sort of the dark part of the film, in my opinion.
Totally.
And I think we'll sort of probably move on to later, but I think you watched the original theatrical cut, and there's like two other versions of the director's cut and the Cabal cut, that it's called. And with the theatrical cut, I believe the production company took away some of the parts of it that made the creatures more likable and more human in a way. Yeah. And they sort of like tried to change it into a bit more of a slasher film.
Yeah.
Which is sort of the Cronenberg character with the mask and sort of walking around with the sort of psycho knife and stuff.
Yeah. And I'm sorry to cut in. I also, another one of my alarming gaps in the horror repertoire, I didn't know what David Cronenberg looked like. So I didn't know that was him. So at the end,
he's usually behind the lens, isn't he?
So I didn't know he did any acting and had appeared in anything. So at the end, when I was like, it wasn't at the end credits. I Googled it during the film. I was like, who's this bloke playing the serial killer? Yeah. He's a bit weird and cool. Why haven't you ever seen him in anything? Google it. It's David Cronenberg. Like, what? Blew my mind.
Yeah, there's quite a lot of sort of random connections with that film. Sort of a bit of a divergence, but you've got sort of Danny Elfman doing the soundtrack, who's probably most famous for Batman and things like that. And then you've got Ralph McQuarrie on all of the sort of the designs of the temple and all the stuff and all the paintings on the wall. It's Ralph McQuarrie who did the very, very original Star Wars concept art. Not the ones that became the main thing, but like the ones that came before it that looked slightly different. Yeah, he did a sort of design on that. So it's a lot of like people who, before they became bigger.
That is interesting, actually.
And it's little people in it and stuff.
It's probably worth, but another thing I always forget to do is like a great big spoiler alert. We're definitely going to spoil this film. So if you fancy watching it, and you should watch it, because it's a dead weird, I'm not even sure what genre it is type of film. Exactly. Yeah. So you should definitely watch it. So if you're interested, pause this, go and watch it, come back, because we will spoil it. But I suppose it's worth mentioning that, like, despite some of those stellar names of people, Clive Barker, Cronenberg's involvement, etc., it was a critical and commercial flop at the time.
It was,
Which, and of course, as, you know, so why are we talking about it then? because it went on to become a cult classic, and it's exactly, a very beloved film by a load of people, which is interesting why that happens sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, I think sort of when we sort of mentioned about the different cuts, I think that probably had something to do with it, whereas, because I believe the Cabal book came out before the film. I know the book came out before the film. And then when the film was released and they sort of edited it down, there was a lot of fans of the book and also fans who could see what the film was trying to be and maybe got lost its way through the sort of studio edits. Yeah. And they're the ones that sort of campaigned for the director's cut and the Cabal cut. The difference between those is the director's cut's all, it's a proper film, you can watch it start to finish, whereas the Cabal cut's got some unedited and sort of raw footage that they sort of interspaced in it. So it's more of a sort of home movie vibes and bits of it and stuff.
Yeah, no, that makes sense.
But it brings up a lot more of the film, and even the ending was different to the actual ending of the films, totally different from the two. I think in the original one, I've forgot his name now. Narcissus, the guy who has his face sort of cut round here.
He was a character, wasn't he?
Yeah, exactly. Well, this is the thing. He was one of the most popular characters from the studio's perspective as well. And he lives throughout the whole film, I'm guessing, in the one you saw. In the director's cut, he dies, like, towards the end. He gets his head chopped off.
It's weird, isn't it? Like, yeah, he's
a comedy sidekick.
Yeah, and he starts off, so when you first meet that bloke, I mean, very, very quick, we won't do like a detail, go through the plot, you'll get the idea as you listen to it, but in simple terms, it's a guy is seeing I always get mixed up with it, it's like psychologist, psychiatrist, psychotherapist, whatever it is.
Whichever one he is, yeah.
Yeah, one of them ones. and he's been having these troubled dreams about this place called Midian that's full of monsters. And his missus, who's really lovely, and the actress who plays his missus, just on this, this was a bit of Googling things. Oh, sorry to jump around. Anne Bobby, who plays the lovely lady friend, she does the voice of Bridget Tenenbaum in Bioshock, Bioshock fans, there you go.
There's loads of small, and the guy who plays Pinhead's in it as well is the
guy
of the thing and everything, and yeah, obviously a Clive Barker connection there,
but he looks completely different, partly because he isn't bald with loads of pins stuck in his head.
Another thing with the edits as well, did he have a German accent in the one you watched?
I'm gonna say yes, he did.
Because they dubbed his voice for the whole film for the theatrical one as well. So it's a different voice for him rather than in the original version of it and stuff.
Which explains why he didn't sound like Pinhead, I guess.
Yeah.
That's weird. Why did they do that anyway? I probably should mention, we've mentioned Cronenberg being in it as the villain, and Bobby as the sort of female lead. And the main protagonist is a fellow called Boone, who's played by Craig Sheffer, who I've never seen in anything ever.
I did a quick sort of IMBD search after we watched it the other night, because I was like, he must have done something else. Because he's actually pretty good in it, I thought. He's actually really
agreed.
Good. James Dean, sort of Brando young version of them, feel to him, I thought. And he's been in a couple of, I think he was in one of the later Hellraiser films, sort of the ones
that
we don't talk about as much and stuff. I didn't see much major that he'd done.
Yeah, this is strange, because I agree with you. It's not like he came across as, like, there's a lot of scope for that character to be a bit boring, because he's a bit of a generic nice guy, he's sort of just a good person, but he does. There's a bit of charisma coming through there,
I guess that's quite a common theme with horror movies, is actors who are big in horror films, they stay in that little genre, and you never really see them
branch out. No, it's true that, and some of them become complete legends, but within this niche, you know, like what's his name, Bruce Campbell and stuff like that. They're all like really well known, but only in that one franchise. That,
yeah, exactly.
So he plays this guy who starts to see this psychiatrist who's called Dr. Decker, I think, Philip Decker, and he is a creepy bastard, and he basically convinces, well, we know that there's a serial killer on the loose in whatever city it's set in, I can't remember. You sort of led down the route of thinking maybe Boone is the serial killer, and that he's murdering people when he's having these weird dreams. He's actually going out and doesn't remember that he's slashing up families and stuff. And you can probably guess where it's not the most unpredictable twist, to be honest. is that it's actually the psychiatrist who's the serial killer. He's just the most horrible man. It's like, not only he's like drugging up his own patients with LSD, masquerading it as something else. He's trying to convince the cops that all his patients are murderers when he's a murderer.
Yeah.
And he's got the creepiest slasher mask.
He does.
That's ever been made. It's the best mask ever.
I've got something on here that we'll to. No, it's not the best picture. You can see it there.
Oh,
it's
that's like a beauty.
It's but the picture inside this that comes in it is that, which is quite a good image that's of it coming up.
Brilliant.
Just him, because he does look great.
Yeah, he's brilliant, suited, smarmy. He's a bit sort of like Patrick Bateman-esque in a way, maybe. Yeah.
But, it's that sort of calm demeanor, isn't it? It's sort of very sort of casual and soft-spoken. Never raises his voice, and
he's a sick man. But the mask is, but for anyone who's listening to the audio version, the mask is basically like a kind of a cloth, a tight-fitting cloth hood.
Yeah, it's almost like skin, like grey skin.
Sort
of with a zip and the button eyes,
Button eyes and the zip, the mouth zip, which is a bit sideways. And for some reason, that's the most disturbing thing about it, the wonky
mouth. Because it's always unzipped as well, so you can just sort of see half his lips sort of in the wrong place, can't you?
I love it. I thought it was brilliant. So yeah, for some reason he puts that on and goes around murdering people, but he's also a successful, wealthy psychiatrist with a dead posh office. And I think this was a really tangential ramble back to the guy you mentioned, who's like the kind of comedy guy in the film.
Yes, yeah.
What's his name? Narcissus?
Narcissus, I believe. Yeah, Narcissus, something like that. Yeah, they've got some very strange names.
I think he's another patient of Decker, who is also having... Yeah. Oh, have I got that?
I don't think he was, because he sort of loses it in the hospital when Boone's there. And then, again, this might be a difference with the two versions, but in the one I watched, Decker comes and he basically says to the cops, like, oh, I'm a psychiatrist, let me talk to him. Yes. I might be able to get him to tell us what's going on. And then he sort of sneaks in and...
Does Decker not the guy is talking about revealing his real face, and there's a proper Clive Barker level of unpleasantness that's cutting bits of his own face off, but I'm trying to remember whether he does that and Decker's like, yeah, do that, go on, good idea. I can't remember that comes
before, because that's when he's talking to Boone and he's in the hospital, he talks to him and then Boone escapes.
Yes.
And then they go in and talk to
the other guy.
Because he keeps talking, because Decker hears him talking about Midian.
Yes.
Because he shouts about it. So then he's like, oh, that's the place that Boone's going. I want to see that as well. He decides he wants to get rid of all of the monsters.
So it's a more coincidental encounter than
I think so, because he's just trying to track. I think sort of the sort of unspoken part is, I think Decker's trying to use Boone to find Midian.
Yes.
Because there's a scene in the one I watched where Decker finds this old guy living in the little hut, and he knows that about the monsters, and he's trying to find them because he wants to clean the world of the monsters, basically.
Yeah.
Seems to be his sort of weird MO type. So I think it's sort of him using, because I'm guessing with the dreams Boone has, Decker knows about those, so he knows about Midian, so he's sort of trying to use him and as a puppet to find the place and...
Yeah, and it probably makes more sense in the book, I suspect, than on my one viewing of the film. It perhaps comes across as slightly confusing, but it's in effect the narrative that leads us towards this place called Midian, which seems ostensibly is just like a knackered old graveyard at the top of an hill. But there's actually this massive sprawling city underneath it where all these, as you say, monsters, words like monsters, freaks, the point being... They've got really, each one's kind of unique and really interesting, weird special effects makeup, latex type
stuff.
But they all, some of the designs are like mad, absolutely crackers.
Yeah, so I literally just went all out with the character designs. I think that's one of the things I really like about it. I just like all these weird and wonderful outcasts, I guess is probably the more friendly term for what they are.
Yeah, exactly.
They sort of found each other and they look after each other, and it's quite, you get that family feel, although they're weird as hell, there's definitely like a family feel to them all, and they're all sort of like friends. And the only one I think is the pelican, I think, the red one with the sneaky dreadlocks.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that we meet him first because he's the only horrible one.
So yeah,
like
exactly,
the first
yeah.
time you meet them, you're like, oh yeah. my God, these people are monsters because he behaves like an actual monster. Whereas the rest, 99% of them are just lovely.
Yeah, especially sort of you've got the sort of the little the guy with the dog and everything that sort of looks like sort of a little friendly one. And even, yeah. even the old guy, Lalsberg, who's sort of in charge, he's sort of got that sort of grandfatherly
yeah,
about him and everything. Yeah.
But it's really good when, you know, I guess in a way it's become a trope in and of itself, but it's the subversion of, so normally society tells you, I guess, and this, you know, speaking from the perspective of a somewhat scrawny, pale man, this, you know, trying to suppress my bitterness, but it's like, if you're, you know, muscular and good looking and handsome, you're the good guy. See Flash Gordon and a million other heroes.
Yeah.
If you're a bit weird looking, then you're evil. See every villain that's ever been done ever.
Exactly.
This is why I always end up rooting for like Jafar and Scar and people in the Disney films.
Because I think that's the sort of the thing I think sort of attracted me to Nightbreed watching it, was that it's like if, putting words in your mouth here, but if like us were maybe feel slightly like outcasts with being writers and what we like, enjoy, if you like enjoying horror films or anything that's cult films and that kind of thing, you feel like you're one of those people. And like you say, most media, they're the ones that are villainized as the bad guys, or they're the ones that aren't right, not quite right. And then Nightbreed, they're the ones that are the good guys. And you've got this sort of, like we say, the psychiatrist guy who's wealthy, he's got looks like a stable career, I guess, and all that kind of stuff. He's doing all the right things, but he's the one that's messed up. And
a literal murderer, so you're killing evil sort of. You're exactly right. So, and maybe that's part of its cult appeal, I guess, is that maybe a lot of people have found, oh, I can, you know, I identify with
relate.
It's kind of nice. And then of course, there's interesting. I remember this once when Lord of the Rings came out, and I think I watched film review or whatever show it was, and Jermaine Greer was on it, and she. Yeah. And everyone was generally effusively praising of the, because I think they're good films and very well made and did a great job of, you know, sort of bringing this legendary story to the screen. But she was having a bit of a pop at Lord of the Rings because she was like, well, why, just because the orcs are like ugly, why do they automatically have to be the villains? And she got a bit shouted down, and it was a bit like, oh, come on, like, don't you know, this is a classic. And I sort of agree with that point. Like, it's probably not the right film to pick on because it's such an old, but there is a point there, isn't there?
Like, of that, yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that's, I've been sort of reading and researching a lot of fantasy, just a slight diversion, but I think Lord of the Rings is one of the few books, sort of traditionally classics, where it is a very clear black and white images on who's the good guys, who's the bad guys in that. Whereas I think things did sort of shift, especially sort of in the 90s, I think there was a bit more of a openness of grey morality and that kind of thing, which I think horror films possibly have the most of in some ways, because even sort of Hellraiser as well, I mean, Clive Barker again, but the Cenobites in that, although they're not the nicest people, they're just kind of doing their thing, and they only seem to really punish bad people. You never really see them do anything to nice people particularly. It's always like...
They've got their
comeuppance, really, the people
In Hellraiser, Pinhead, who you'd be forgiven for thinking is the villain, is not the villain of that film. Like, he actually... It's sort of the villain is again, I'll just try to avoid spoilers, but the villain is a different person who definitely, by the time he's getting ripped to shreds by Pinhead and his mates, you're like, yes, good, you deserve that, you bastard.
I think that's what I think horror films do that quite a lot. But with Nightbreed, it's just that whole family and community of outcasts, and a band of misfits is a trope that I do like in a lot of things, whether or not it's sort of a spaceship crew who are all a bit sort of on the brinks of the sort of normal and things, or monsters and creatures who are living in their own little world and doing their own thing. And I just like that aspect of stories, I think. And it's
Totally. And Boone definitely sort of, you know, the narrative essentially takes the route of he finds Midian and is introduced to these people. Oh, well, sorry, he dies. I forgot that bit.
That's a small part of that.
Decker manages to convince the cops that, like, he's, you know, this guy is on, who's on the run now is the killer and is the serial killer. And then he convinces, and then he sort of says, oh, let me talk to it. Like, when are the police going to learn? Whenever Decker says, oh, let me, I'll handle this. It's like, that's never worked. So he goes up and he's like, oh, I'll talk to him. And then he lies and says Boone's got a gun. So the police shoot him about 5 billion times, just really shooting lots and lots to make sure. But then he's, because he's been, I think,
bitten by that
hand wavy, he's been bitten by that nasty one, the dreadlocks dude, who's a bit, who's a bit sort of grumpy. That bite enables him to sort of resurrect as a sort of as like a. What's the word? Like, what's the word to describe the people who live in Midian? Are they actually called the Nightbreed?
The Nightbreed, their sort of term. I mean, in the, again, I don't know if it's cut from the one you watch, but there's like a scene nearish the start, I believe, where you sort of see a bit of a history of how they all got there and where they all come from. And there was like, sort of back in the Dark Ages, there was like a witch hunt where they killed and chucked them all into pits and were massacring all and everything. And then they all sort of, whoever survived, sort of got themselves together. I think that's why they call themselves the Night Breed, because they're the breed that hides in the night kind of thing. And it's all sort of like...
They're meant to be some sort of, I don't know, alternative offshoot of humanity that's been kind of culled in the past. And these are the surviving kind of remnants who are just, like you say, just trying to hide and keep themselves. Yeah. Boone is comes back to life in the morgue. And he in effect ends up finding his way to Midian, where he learns, oh right, that bloke who attacked me and bit me, he was a bit of an exception, everyone else is nice, including that bloke with the really funny shaped head, who is
a crescent moon type thing, isn't it?
Yeah, he's cool. And they sort of the guy with who I must reveal my real face, he's so is he dead by this point? Has he been resurrected as well, or is he?
So, yeah, that was never really sort of clear in the film. I figure, because this is the one thing that I sort of question mark I have with the film, and I've not read the book for a long time, so I can't remember if it's answered in there, was because Boone was having the dreams of Midian, and you can assume that other guy was as well, because he's speaking about it. And it's like, was he already going to go there anyway if he hadn't got bitten and died and then turned into a creature? Because if he's having the dreams about it, was he already sort of
destined
to go there the same as the other was? And I wonder, I mean, you could sort of say maybe it's sort of, if they all offshoot some humanity, maybe there's a genetic marker or something that sort of they're still part of that bloodline or something.
That makes sense. As you say, it's not really explained in the film.
But yeah, he ends up there as well, the guy who's cut his face.
And the time when we saw him do that, it was like a really harrowing, disturbing, distressing scene with a mentally ill man mutilating himself. Next time you meet him, he's all like wisecracks and like smoking a cigarette in an inappropriate way. And, oh, sorry.
He's sort of I think he's the best, one of the best characters in it for sure.
Yeah, just definitely.
His friendly nature. And I think it was needed because it gets quite dark towards the second half of the film with everything happening, whereas he still sort of adds a bit of humour to it all.
I suppose you could say, that, I guess there's loads of, that you say, sort of intertwining influences all over the place. You could say it's probably a bit Lovecraftian, this idea of visions of an ancient city and, you know, with strange creatures living in it. There's definitely a bit of Lovecraft going on.
Yeah.
But he avoids that, he doesn't go down the tentacles route. It's all much more, to me, much more kind of original and interesting, the designs.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, just walking through the whole underground caves when you're seeing all the different things passing by, it's just great. You just want to sort of pause it and have a look at all the different creatures they've developed, because they're all, like I said, all unique, but they all look right as well in a weird kind of way. They all look like, oh yeah, you can believe all these people are living there, and or that I believe the set, because it was filmed in Pinewood Studios near London, and that whole thing with all the walkways and the rope walks and everything, they built that as an actual massive set, like a huge set. So I watched some of the sort of behind the scene documentary stuff the other day, And yeah, you see sort of some of the sort of how they built it and what it looks like. It's just epic because it all existed as an actual place when they built it.
And, again, this is becoming so hackneyed for me to say this, but I basically just moan about CGI all the time. But it's like that, yeah, it's not just the characters and monsters and so on. It's also, like you say, the locations, like that, strung together bridges and sort of rickety wooden walkways. That you can tell it's real and it's a real place where the actors were really in. It's not just a green screen with a load of...
I think that's sort of something, especially with horror films, to have a good horror film that ages well, don't use CGI. Because CGI ages straight away. Like, 5 years later, it looks dated. Whereas when you've got real-life buildings and animatronics and things that have actually got real flesh or made-up flesh as puppets and stuff, it lasts so much longer because it looks... so much better. I mean,
totally agree.
I think that's why there's sort of like, I think like an era of horror films that have managed to do that. And you've got sort of like The Thing and sort of John Carpenter's most of his work anyway. And some of like the Clive Barker and like say sort of Hellraiser with The Thing coming out the floorboards and everything.
Yeah.
They still look great now because they've used real props and products and things to do it rather than digital stuff that never looks good after a while.
It just never does.
Even when they do, when it releases, it doesn't always look that great.
I completely agree with that. So, hopefully they'll continue to... I mean, I think people generally, more and more people getting on board with this viewpoint, and therefore, hopefully, we'll start to see more films only use CGI when you need to use it because you can't do the thing with animatronics. If you can do it with physical things, please do it. Yeah.
Things that aren't necessarily in the forefront. That's the difference, I think, for sure.
Yeah. And so Boone ends up sort of joining the community and becoming one of the Nightbreed, which is good. But by this point, you know, various antagonistic forces are now pointed towards the city, not just Decker, who's decided he's on some sort of weird quasi-religious mission to kill them all for some reason. I think we end up with the police end up making a kind of a sortie into the city to try and wipe it out, featuring the most hilariously like jock, like sort of what's the word I'm looking for, like brash, arrogant sort of cigar smoking police chief, like ever. Cool. He's brilliant. Like he was, to be honest, like he was my favourite character at that point.
It's like he came in from another film and was just like
exactly
the door down and barged
his exactly film. What it's like. Where did he come from and why was he not in it earlier?
He's just like, right.
Just a nasty, like, and he's got a sort of a weird, I don't know. He's clearly a big bloke, but in a sort of in a slightly odd, is he muscly or is he fat kind of, I can't quite work him out kind of way. And he's kind of... like
he wants to be the big muscly guy, but he's not quite got it. So he sort of like pads himself up a bit. And
yeah, he looks, there's something a bit odd about his general kind of build. And then, and he's got like, he's kind of balding and he wears glasses. So he doesn't, he's sort of missed the mark with what he's trying to be, but he really goes for it. So it's fine.
Yeah. And everyone just accepts it, like, yeah, okay.
Yeah, well, he's the chief. Like, yeah, so it's basically like if they sort of cast like a nerdy bloke to play a muscle bound jock character by mistake.
Yeah.
But in a good way. His name, the actor is Charles Hayde, who is still knocking about, I think, and still doing stuff. He's been in quite a few other things, which I haven't seen, but I kind of want to watch him now.
Yeah, just to see if he's that same character in all of them, or does he?
I hope so.
even if it's exactly the same characters barging into different films.
And there was the end, so that whole sort of finale where him and the cops rock up and invade Midian and start fighting with all the residents. And there's loads of cool, like, you know, I'm going to shoot you with my gun. And then the other guys are like, oh, I'm going to kill you with my snakes that come out of my belly. That was really cool. But it was a bit like a sort of a Clive Barkerified version of, you know, the ending of Beauty and the Beast, where like all the townsfolk try and attack all the beast's castle. It was kind of a bit like that, but gory.
Yeah. Yeah, I know you mean sort of like a darker version of it. Like,
yeah.
But yeah, I think that again, that was sort of the great thing of seeing all the different creatures and what they can maybe do. And I think it's sort of, it makes you, one of the good things, it makes you want to know more about them. but sort of it shows you just enough to make you sort of go, are these really interesting characters and creatures? And but there's no more. But they did a comic book series of it afterwards, which I haven't read, to be fair.
And
explore some of the characters a bit more, which might be sort of something I want to look into trying to find.
Yeah,
that's like the whole fight scene stuff. It's sort of a little bit over the top in some parts.
Definitely.
Of like the sort of like flamethrowers and everything sort of coming out. But then I think it's sort of a good commentary on like people not, if they don't accept or understand something, then they just go nuts and trying to wipe it out.
Yeah.
Because there's a scene where the sort of the most human looking of the Nightbreed, sort of the guy who holds the dog and everything, he sort of falls outside into the sun and starts to burn a little bit. And the police just start sort of wailing on him and stuff. And it's just like, he doesn't even look that different. He's one of the more normal creatures. It's just sort of the trigger of it. And just, they don't understand it. So they just want to
kill him, Although there is that one, they don't do, I'm not entirely sure. I'm trying to remember how this resolves itself or whether it does, but there's one relatively senior police guy who is after Decker tells them all that Boone's got a gun, so they shoot him. Yeah. He's the only one who's like, oh, where's his gun that you said that he had? Because I can't see one. So he's a bit, in that scene where they're all putting the boot into the iron guy, he sort of stands back and he's a bit horrified. Mm.
But yeah, you're waiting for him to step in.
But he just doesn't do anything.
So that's, I guess whether or not it's sort of like looking around, like he's not going to be able to stop all these madmen sort of doing their thing and whatever. So whether or not he sort of backs away a little bit.
He finds the mask in Decker's car, who just like, he's just got it on his dashboard. Like, he's just not even going to be asked to put it in the glove box. and he's like, oh, what's this, doctor? And the doctor's like, I'm not sure if he even bothers with the story or just stabs him.
I just think he just does it, just gets rid of him.
he is a nasty piece of work. And Decker himself, he ends up involved in that sort of finale scene. Hmm. So while Midian is getting sort of torched, he's in there like, get the mask on.
Doing his thing.
Get involved. Have some fun. And of course, that leads you to sort of a climactic scene where him and Boone have a fight.
Yeah.
And I think by this point the tide has turned because the Nightbreed release, they've got some like locked away feral Nightbreed people who
the ones that have gone a bit too far.
Like, oh, you got carried away and let's just keep you downstairs. But they sort of come out and wipe the floor with all the policemen and all his cronies, and the swaggering police chief has to like get in his car and legs it. Does he die? Does he get killed? I can't remember what happens to the police chief.
In the one I watched, because the end of the one I watched, it sort of sets up as it could have been really good for some sort of sequel with him in it, because there's the preacher guy who's along with them all, and he gets sort of burnt, and he's, by the end of it, he looks like one of the monsters, although he's not, he's just been sort of tarnished or something.
Yeah.
But he's there. And he's sort of looking around, sort of saying he wants to get basically revenge because they've not accepted him for whatever reason. And the police chief there, and they're sort of like, they become like a sort of like a, we're going to find them and let's go and hunt them down kind of thing. So you've got like this great creature, and sort of he's been burnt to like shreds and stuff, but you've got like the chief police officer, and they're both sort of like, oh, that would have been sort of a really good.
I'd watch that as well. Oh, someone make that. That'd be ace.
The Garth Ennis creature, he looks a bit like him, and you can sort of see it being some sort of character sort of hunting down the crazy creatures and stuff.
That would be a good story.
I don't know if the comics follow that story or not, but after rewatching it, I think I might want to hunt them down and find out.
Probably worth a read, actually. At the time of recording, the last episode we put out was about Big Trouble in Little China, and there's a sequel of that that is a comic.
I've read some of them. Well, there's, being a massive Kurt Russell fan and John Carpenter. When I looked back through your back catalogue thinking of what we were going to talk about, I was like, they've done John Carpenter. So there's a weird comic series where they all the different versions of Kurt Russell together. So you've got, not all of them, but you've got Snake Plissken meets Jack Burton. You've got the two of them together. And it's sort of like they really work because they're similar but different, but it's a great, it's not the sure it's like high quality of like literature or anything, but it's an entertaining story. Yeah.
And more,
there's another one. I'm sure there's another Kurt Russell in it as well, but I can't remember which one now. Yeah.
Because he's different in every film he's ever in, which he even makes The Christmas Chronicles watchable just because it's him as Santa, because that is a crap film.
But. Yeah.
You can still get through it because Kurt Russell's playing the lead. But,
anything he's in is worth watching. Just
automatically good. I guess to conclude on Nightbreed from a sort of plot perspective, the one bit I kind of missed out was Boone's. They're not married, are they? It's his girlfriend.
No, yeah, it's his girlfriend.
The character's name I have failed to write down. But she.
Laurie.
Laurie, that's it. And she, I think she isn't, she doesn't become, in the theatrical original version, she doesn't become a Nightbreed, but she sort of stays with Boone despite his Nightbreedliness. Mm-hmm. And I think the ending is, he's going to help them find a new home because their home's been smashed up by the cops. and that's kind of it, really. It's sort of like in a way, it's like a happy ending. Him and Laurie still together. They're going to help the Nightbreed and then move on with their lives. And then there's a weird scene where that religious dude is like doing a ritual in the ruins of Midian to resurrect Decker with his mask on, which is, okay, cool.
Well, that's a sort of complete different to the director's cut version. Because in that one, basically, very same thing. All the monsters are sort of hiding out in a shed in a barn somewhere, and Boone's going to help them find their next place. And Laurie basically says, "I'm coming with you." And he's just like, "Well, you can't, because these are all monsters, basically." And so they start to walk away, and then she kills herself. She stabs herself, drops to the ground, and then Boone's kind of like, "Oh," and then he bites her and brings her back as one of the Nightbreed and sort of turns her. And then that's a bit more of a love story type thing rather than just like, let's go and help them. It's like sacrifice yourself to sort of stay together.
Yeah, that makes a lot more sense. That's a much better ending, isn't it?
Yeah,
that's
there's a great scene where they're both stood on the sort of the hill after they've been turned and looking down at the monsters, almost like their new saviors kind of thing, and leading them to the next promised land type thing. Yeah, the Decker thing, the resurrection thing doesn't happen. But I think that was, again, the studio wanting to have it as like the slasher bad guy coming back kind of thing. And, cliche sort of style of it and things, but it's sort of very different in the other version, which I think works better in how the director's cut.
Sounds a lot more logical, albeit like I did read very briefly like a Barker saying that he thinks it was a flop because the studio kind of put the ramped up the slasher bit, which it isn't really, and marketed it as if it was a slasher movie, but I would watch a slasher movie with Decker in. So I don't have a problem with that.
He's a great creature, sort of creature, but sort of mental madness. And then just his style of just talking, everything's just so creepy.
Cronenberg. It's kind of made me want to go and watch more David Cronenberg films. Again, I've seen some, but not all of his entire back catalogue. So it's
You may be similar to me. Like, I mean, it was probably about X amount of years ago, back when it used to just be four or five TV channels, and you just put the TV on it in the middle of the night and just watch whatever random horror film came on. No idea who wrote it, who directed it, anything. We just see them. And that's how I saw Nightbreed for the first time. I saw the name, and I was just like, that's a cool name. Let's watch that.
You're exactly right. And that is a lost thing, I guess, for younger generations. I guess you'll never know that I've got four channels, so all I can watch is what's on these four channels, and I'm going to flick through, and it might just be, and I'm a teenager, and I'm in my bedroom, and that's all I've got to do, and it'll either be the news, Gardener's World, some crap, romance thing or whatever, and then channel four would have been some like edgy weird. And then, or if you were lucky, it's like, a film that's just starting, and I haven't missed the beginning. Like, the films I've seen two-thirds of because you missed the start.
Start into it, like, this looks interesting. No idea how it started, but I'll just keep watching it and see what happens.
Like, I remember watching, I think I put it on. I'd never heard of it, didn't know what it was, and it was as the opening sort of credits were coming on. And it had, like, cool, I don't know, cello music or whatever. And I was like, I'll just watch this. And it ended up being The Usual Suspects. Like, can you imagine? I was like, I've just seen the best film ever. Like, Mum! Don't tell me parents, they're in bed.
That's the thing, it's like watching films where you don't know what they're about.
Yeah.
I think it's a nice experience. I used to go to like HMV or Virgin Megastores. It's just like 10 DVDs for a fiver, right? What's got a cool title and a cool cover?
Brilliant. Yeah, like so spoiler free that you've not even read the blurb kind of thing.
Yeah. It sounds good. Or you read the back and it says zombies. Like, yeah, fine.
Yeah.
I want to watch it because it says zombies.
Well, that's a good way to consume films, I think.
Yeah. I mean, just sort of diverging a little bit, but I think generally with music and with movies and media in general, because we've got things like Netflix, Spotify, where you can sit and browse and watch the trailer and decide, you'll spend hours upon hours searching for something to watch. Because you're reading all the details to try and decide. And then if you'll end up watching something, if you're lucky, if you manage to choose something before it's past midnight.
Yeah, totally.
You know all about it already. You know who's in it and all the rest of it. Whereas back then, you'd find things you would never have thought to watch that suddenly become, I really like this. And I wouldn't normally have watched it if I'd known what it was beforehand with blurb, and the blurb's not a great blurb, but you'll watch it anyway. So yeah, I think it's sort of a lost art, like we say, of finding hidden gems. It doesn't happen anymore.
Totally agree. And trailers as well are getting worse for that. Like, if you watch old trailers, that cryptic, 1 minute long, not really sure, don't give too much away now. It's like, right, but here's a synopsis of the entire plot of the film for 3 solid minutes with all the best bits in it.
Like, it was all the first, like, three quarters of the plot, and you might get a little bit at the end that you don't know.
Yeah, like, there's a film I have not seen and probably would have seen and probably will enjoy, but I'm not going to watch it because I honestly feel like the trailer has just told me the old film. The Invisible Man film that came out a couple of years ago?
Yeah, the new one,
There's just no need. I've seen it. Yeah. I've seen a five-minute summary of it.
I've seen the trailer and I've not seen it. But yeah, I've seen the trailer and I was like, unless there's some really dramatic changes like halfway through, you kind of know pretty much where it's going to go. Although I've heard it's really good, actually. So.
Me too. But even like, there's a bit in the trailer where, so it introduces its concept. There's a creepy invisible man who's bad, and there's a woman who's, you know, he's tormenting her and no one believes her because he's invisible, so they think she's crazy. Fine. But then it shows far too much, loads of that, unnecessarily loads. And then it shows a scene where she, like, catches him out and she's like, aha, I can see you, or something. Yeah. It's like, no, don't show us that she gets that to come up and
that's on him. That's one of the sort of, like, good moments in the film where you go, yeah, she's figured out the thing to do. Whereas if you know it's coming, you're just waiting for it.
Correct. So I'm sorry, this is a completely irrelevant rant, but that trailer really annoyed me. A good thing about Nightbreed, I would say, is one of its many good things, is it has got that completely, I don't even know what type of, I have no idea what's going to happen.
Yeah, what genre that film is. Like, you'd probably call it horror, but I don't know.
Dark fantasy, but it's not really a fantasy because it's set in the real world, but it is a fantasy because it's got weird creatures in it. It's really unique kind of thing.
It is. It's definitely different. It's got a lot of different... I think it's just a very much an ideas film. There's just so many things in it that it makes it feel like there's such a bigger world behind it as well. And I think it's always great when films do that where you see this part of it, but you could imagine so much more being there that isn't revealed in the film. I think that's quite a good Clive Barker, and even like Hellraiser, where, I mean, the Cenobites are only in it for like probably 10 minutes if you added it all up, but you feel so much more behind it, and it sort of adds that backstory without going over the top with it and stuff. Yeah.
I totally agree with that. It sort of alludes to there being this bigger world that you've not been allowed to see. So like you say, spin-off sequels, there's lots of kind of potential. I was going to ask you, Nick, because when you introduced yourself earlier, we probably didn't cover well enough your own work and your own books. Mm. So I was going to ask you whether Nightbreed had any particular influence on you and your kind of writing style.
I'd say it probably did. I was thinking about my influences and stuff when we sort of initially sort of started talking about having a chat and things. And I realised that things about, like with Nightbreed, where the monsters aren't always the bad guys, and that idea of, I'd say sort of like everyone's a hero in their own world. So like villains don't see themselves as villains and that kind of thing. And I'd say most of my books I've wrote, so there's the Neon Helix universe, which is a sort of cyberpunk stories, as Neon Helix, Neon Cortex and Neon Blood. And there's also the Omega Drive, which is more of a space opera. But the bad guys that are in those, they have their own motivations and their own things. And you can actually sort of go, actually, yeah, I can understand their perspective. And I've even had quite a few people, especially from reading Neon Helix, that say, I'm not sure who the bad guy is meant to be.
Brilliant.
Which in some ways people might say is a bad thing because it's not clear. But then I've done it on purpose because I want you to sort of go, actually, I understand where they're coming from.
Yeah, totally.
And if you can understand that, it adds more to the characters and sort of the plot, I think, because if you've got carbon cutter characters who are, they're bad for their own reasons, but you don't know those reasons and they're not understandable and they don't really make any sense, it takes you away from them and they become separate. Whereas if you can actually connect with them and understand their reasons, you may not agree with their reasons, and they may still seem like the bad guy, but you can empathize with what they're doing and why they're doing it.
Yes.
I think that's definitely influenced me quite a lot in sort of developing stories, for sure. And then, again, the sort of ragtag bunch of misfits sort of trope is definitely a thing. It's more so in the Omega Drive, which is a crew on a ship and all that kind of stuff, where
they
look after each other and they're all friends and they do whatever they need to do to look after each other. And that's sort of in all my sort of stories, I always have a group of people seems to come together. Really? Even for the planet, they just seem to do that.
that's really good. That's really good. And yeah, you're exactly right about that whole thing about people. And people want that now. People won't accept, I'm a villain for no apparent reason. It's just that's kind of a dead thing now. You've got to have more of a three-dimensional character. People seem to like that whole, almost like anti-heroes. Almost, even, you know, there's a lot of shows now where like the main protagonist is kind of the villain now. People like it. So you're spot on.
I think for me, it stems from films like Nightbreed, where it's that not everyone is what they appear to be, and the bad guys could be the good guys, and the good guys could be the bad guys, and it's just all how you portray it and things like that.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of horror films, I mean, there's different, obviously, in horror films, it's quite a massive genre, obviously, but there's sort of, if people think who aren't necessarily well-versed in horror films, they always just see it as like the slasher, the creature, the Freddy Krueger, the Jason, they're always pretty much, I mean, they newer films, they try and add more backstory and sympathizing elements to them, but traditionally they are just this thing going around killing people for the hell of it, usually.
Yeah, no, it's a really interesting point, that, because when you do, this is not to sort of be elitist, you know, people who don't understand horror, but it's maybe there is a tendency for people to think that there's an assumption that people make that it's about, you know, who's the baddie and what's the baddie's gimmick? You know, how does this baddie kill people? And it's like, they don't all have to be that story. There's different stories you can tell.
It adds more when there's sort of more background to them and why they're doing the thing. And again, they can still be this nutter going around killing people. But as long as you can understand why they're doing it a little bit more, it maybe takes away from the horror aspect a little bit, because I guess the more you know, the less scary it is as well. Which is sort of a
balance to be had. I mean, this is just sort of popped into my head for some reason, only because I was talking about this character the other day. But like, I'm a big Batman fan. But I think my favourite iterations of Batman is maybe some of the Frank Miller and also Michael Keaton's original Batman, because they both portray him basically as a borderline sort of, what's the word I'm looking for? He likes hurting criminals. He's horrible. He's really violent and batters them to within an inch of their life and sometimes kill. So there's this whole thing about, like, in Batman where it's like, oh, Batman's not supposed to kill the villains, you know, he's very has a moral code. I'm like, that's in the cartoon, and the cartoon was good, but you could have a completely different take on him where he borderline is a villain and he's
if this has happened, it must have happened. Someone must have already written this, but you could easily do a Batman story from the perspective of like a street villain, like a criminal, like Bob's Bank or Bob's Corner Stores, and he would be a slasher character.
Exactly. Yeah.
He goes around beating up everybody.
Yeah.
And you're terrified of him. And that's sort of like his gimmick, is that he goes around and terrifies the hell out of criminals on the street.
Yeah.
And you could do a whole story of him being this slasher.
Like a bogeyman kind of figure, and really go to town on that. Again, it's probably been done. That's the problem, isn't it? Every good idea always turns out. This happened to me the other day, right? Sorry, complete tangent. I'm going to tell you this. I was talking to somebody who potentially wants to try and put together a bit of like an anthology of like horror stuff, and I'd suggested, because I've made this point a few times about it's really hard to come up with like an original monster. So maybe the theme of this anthology should be everyone's got to come up with an original monster story. That would be quite cool. And then, and part of the reason for me proposing that was because I'd had an idea and I was, haha, this is a good idea. And I was like, so we got talking and then I said, okay, you know, what about a sentient evil bed? And it's like, so it's not like, oh, there's a monster under my bed. It's like, no, the bed itself is the monster. I thought this was a good idea. And the guy goes, oh, you mean like Deathbed? I was like, what? What's Deathbed? Just a film and a book that exists called Deathbed about a sentient evil bed that eats people. And you're like, oh, bollocks! I can't believe somebody came up with that idea. Oh, well,
so,
never mind.
So many ideas. I mean, the thing is as well, I mean, like, talking about writing and stuff, but like, people say like every plot's already been written. It's just how you've developed it and you write it. So, but yeah, it's hard when it's a bit demoralizing, isn't it? When you come and like, you search a little bit, like, never mind.
It's so annoying. but like you say, you shouldn't be too put off by, oh, I've just found out the idea I've had turned, like Hunger Games. Lots of people say she ripped off Battle Royale. She says she didn't and had never heard of it. And she's probably telling the truth. Oh, she just found out afterwards that, that idea's kind of been done. Oh, well, never mind. And it didn't stop her from being very successful.
No, exactly, it's done amazing. I mean, it's a very different story. I mean, I love Battle Royale. It's a great film. But then Hunger Games, it's a good trilogy of books as well.
Yeah, agreed.
It does what it needs to do really well. And very different. Yeah, there's so many ideas that are, so, I mean, that whole concept of those is probably been done a million times in other areas as well, hasn't it? So.
Agreed. And speaking of good books, definitely massive shout out to your series of, I guess the Amiga Drive, as you say, is that a separate standalone?
Yeah, well, it's probably going to be a trilogy. I've only sort of done the first book of it so far, but it ends. I think it's a satisfying ending, but it does end with like some massive questions to be asked and that kind of thing that need answering. But
the other books are yours. Are the it's I think the first one, if I've got my facts right, it's Neon Helix, Neon Cortex, and Neon Blood. And I did like your covers are amazing. They look amazing. If you've got them to hand, please showcase away.
So the Neon Cortex is it's a short novella. You can get it free on my mailing list. Don't have to buy it. You can get a hard copy if you want the cover. And then Neon Blood is that one, which is... Neon Blood's got a lot more sort of darker stuff to it, obviously the name. It's got my cyberpunk version of vampires in there that I tried to make sense in a cyberpunk world.
Brilliant.
Which I managed to do quite well.
I'm positive you have. I have not read any of the Neon books yet, but I have read. How you and me know each other is through we sort of involved in like a cyberpunk writers group who collaborated on an anthology, which is there it is, the Neo Cyberpunk thing. Your story in that is brilliant. I love that. And without giving away any, in effect, it's like a cyberpunk. I'm going to say I think it's called a synth weaver, but it's like a DJ, and it's almost like an augmented DJ who does like soundscapes and visuals, but you know, something actually goes a bit wayward. And you had in that story, you had a great example of a thing I like is clever acronyms in fiction. So you had the technology that is used is the Cortex Overwhelming Disruption Audio, which is obviously CODA. I was like, yes, that's genius. Well done.
I spent hours trying to figure that one out.
Brilliant.
I was like, here's some musical words. I need to try and get something that makes sense in there. Because I do like putting hidden things in my stories. And I mean, even in that one, the main character, sort of the Simpery, the DJ, he calls himself Shinobi. And the female character in it, I used the I can't even remember what it is now, but it's the female name of a female ninja. It's sort of, I mean, I'm a massive Marvel geek from the comics, and even in the Neon Helix books, there's hidden things that are related to Marvel. If you know Marvel and you knew to look for it, you'd see them. Like, it probably doesn't even spoil anything, but there's a character called Peter in there, as in Peter Parker, but there's also another character who has a connection to him without spoiling anything, and his name's Riley, which if you know Spider-Man comics, Ben Riley, and it mixes into the plot of the book, and it kind of, just little things that if people know it, they'll...
Oh, it's great. It's loads of fun doing stuff like that. I've read all the Jack Reacher novels because I just love them. I read the first one, was about 14, and just never grew out of it. And I did actually clock this before it was officially known, because I suppose if you watch a lot of football in the 90s, it was kind of one of loads of characters named after Villa players. He's a Villa fan. Lee Charles like, you know, Jack Reacher squared up to Staunton and Milosevic. It's like, hang on a minute. Steve Staunton and Savo Milosevic. That's too much of a coincidence.
Yeah. It's when you start realizing that writers, they do struggle with names sometimes. They're like, right, they need something that they can use as a thing to help them do it. And it adds something as well for people that notice it, for sure.
Yeah, this happens to me all the time. I don't know if you do this. It's placeholder name goes in. Yeah. And then I just get attached to the placeholder name.
Yeah.
So just that becomes the name, even if it's daft or even if it's clearly lifted from some other thing.
Yeah. So it's amazing how often you sort of names are one of the hardest things, I think, when you're writing, like, especially when you're sort of in the flow of writing and a new character pops up but you haven't given a name yet, you're like, I don't know. It usually sticks, to be fair.
Until your editor points out that you've got like five characters whose names all begin with B and they all sound a bit similar, and oh no, I've got to change them. It's horrible.
That's one of the key things. Is like, get the alphabet out and make sure you're ticking off the different letters.
It's weird, isn't it, of these things you don't think of until you sort of start doing it. Well, Nick, we diverged significantly in a good way. But just to conclude on Nightbreed, of course, this is the tense moment when we reveal whether Nightbreed has made it into the Hall of Pain. And of course, it's infamously difficult to do so, as anyone who's listened to every episode of the show and everything that we've ever covered has always got in will know. But you never know, one day there could be a pitch that fails dismally, and today is not that day. So Nightbreed is, of course, welcomed with open arms into, you know, some parallels there. It is underground. It's got lots of weirdos in it. So maybe, in a way, the Hall of Pain is a bit like a new Midian. But if anything, probably the avatar of Nightbreed that will live in the Hall of Pain is probably Decca with his mask on. So not as nice as the residents of Midian.
He's definitely the darkest part of the film, for sure.
Yeah, and the best bit, apart from the police chief. Yeah. Maybe it's the police. We'll put the police chief in there as well.
They
can share a cell.
I would say just one of my favourite quote from the whole film. It's the thing Pelican says, the red tentacle guy, when Boone first meets him, he's like, oh, is this all this real? And he says, it's all true. God is an astronaut. Oz is over the rainbow, and Midian is where the monsters live. And I think that's just a great line for the film.
Absolutely brilliant. Love it. I forgot it. That's almost like his opening play, isn't it? That's how he introduces himself.
But it is, yeah. It's a great line to introduce yourself to.
It is a good line.
It might not work.
He comes across as one of those. You know those fellas who, like, you'd see in the pub who were, like, very willfully alternative, and they'd maybe have, like, a pet snake and that they just always bring to the pub as, like, a talking point. And at first you're like, whoa, this guy's really cool. And then when you've seen him about 10 times doing the same shtick, you're like, he's getting on the nerves a bit now. He kind of reminded me of one of them.
Yeah, it's just him. Just you get used to him.
Yeah. Oh, is he talking about Oz again? Oh, eye roll.
Just get him a pint and he'll be quiet.
Yeah, that's. I think that's how he comes in. Like, you think he's going to be the villain at first.
Yeah, just, you do. Yeah.
He's not even that big a character by the end. That's him. Well, Nick, thank you very, very much for joining us to discuss.
Thank you for having me.
Which I'm very glad I have now watched.
Yeah.
Did you want to, in terms of your sort of contact details or whether there's any announcements or Twitter handles or anything else you wanted to drop?
I mean, I'm nickwhittaker.com is the website. Everything links through from there. But if you just put Nick Whittaker, N-I-K, it's the only awkward thing because my parents were big Nick Kershaw fans. That's where that comes from. So, yeah, I'm not Greek or anything like that. It'd be more cool if I was. But so, yeah, Nick, N-I-K, Whittaker. And yeah, you'll find me on most social media. And like I say, if you do want to read any of my stuff, Neon Cortex, which you can read without reading any of the books, you can get free by signing up to my mailing list. That's what I do. And I've hopefully got a fantasy novel coming out towards the end of the year. That's my plan, which just has some dark stuff in it.
Fantastic. Yeah, exactly. I was going to say I would expect nothing less. But it's great that you're doing a bit of genre hopping as well and trying some different things.
Doing sort of constantly sci-fi. I felt like I want to do something very different and fantasy. Same but different. I mean, fantasy and sci-fi always get muzzled, put together as a sci-fi and fantasy, but they are very different in their way as well.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And well, we'd look forward to that because I bet that'll be a really good. I'm convinced that'll be a really good read. And I didn't know that you got Neon Cortex free, so I'm going to go and sign up to your mailing list now. get me free book.
Get it. It's got a character that I think you like actually called Salem. He's very quick divergent. Have you ever read Transmetropolitan, the comics?
I haven't.
Better if you haven't.
Good. That's good.
He's a very British punk sort of style character that I think is really good.
Excellent. Like a sort of a Johnny Rotten-esque kind of cyberpunk.
Yeah, he's a little bit like he just goes around and he's sort of not very PC and I think you'll enjoy him.
I'm sure I will. And Nick, thank you very much again for your time. It's been a pleasure to talk to you as I knew it would be, and hopefully speak to you again soon.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to do another one. It's great fun. And fantastic. I might try and bring some of that won't make it in just on purpose.
So have a go at like the crappiest possible pitch just to see it was like, this is a bit awkward. How do we tell him? A bit like a really notoriously rubbish horror thing. I'm trying to think what that might be. But they're all good.
Yeah.
cheers, Nick, and we'll speak to you again soon. Thanks, everybody, for listening.
Thanks so much. Catch you later.
Thank you once again for listening and joining us for a thrilling episode of Dark Natter with Nick, who was a brilliant guest. So thanks once again to Nick. Do make sure you check out all his stuff. And also check out Neo Cyberpunk, which was the anthology that we both wrote a submission for. I think we mentioned it in the episode. That is available on Amazon if you search for Neo Cyberpunk. And by the time this is published, we might even have Volume 2 out, which we're both contributing to again. So that would be good fun, won't it? That's it. Usual announcements apply, as in, please give us a 5-star review. Please, 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 because that's really helpful, mainly for our egos. Get in touch. We'd love to hear your feedback on the show. Best route is probably Twitter, where we are at @dark_natter. That's it from me, and we will be back in a couple of weeks with more Dialogue of Doom.